From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made this past summer during a highly publicized local trial. A teenage student had accused a teacher and basketball coach in a local district of rape. The teacher offered an extensive defense, including an alibi. The student said she waited to tell anyone for months because she was devastated and scared. Well, those were some of the themes at the heart of this trial, and reporters from just about every local news outlet covered the trial. And during it, many reporters tweeted details of testimony. It's a common practice. Modern technology allows journalists to report the news essentially instantly if they want. There are no editors on Twitter or social media. The deadline is always now. Critics have come to see this method of reporting as potentially sloppy, even dangerous. And some of those critics were called to testify during the trial this past summer. They expressed concern that the alleged victim could be identified, even accidentally. They expressed frustration that expert testimony can be misunderstood by reporters who might lack certain training. The solution, some say, is to ask judges to ban social media reporting during trials. They want reporters to cover trials in their totality, to take their time, to work with editors, to fact check. Journalists generally respond that if there are mistakes, that's evidence of the need for better training, not a ban on communication. Judges have largely come around on issues like Twitter. In the early days of social media a decade ago, judges would rather routinely block reporters from using technology or limit it. But over time, many judges have expressed appreciation for what well-trained journalists can do with the medium. So this hour, a conversation, a debate of sorts. Should journalists pump the brakes, so to speak? Should they stop and think whether they should, not just whether they could? Or can we all find benefits in modern tools of reporting? Let's welcome our guest in studio for the hour. Dr. Elizabeth Murray is a pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thank you.
Also with us is Allison O'Malley, the Chief Executive Officer of Resolve. Welcome back to you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We have Scott Maloof, an attorney whose practice focuses on the intersection of social media and the law. Welcome back, Scott.
Thanks, Evan.
And a couple of reporters for the Democrat and Chronicle. Hello to Will Cleveland. Hi, Will.
Hey, Evan. Thanks for having me.
And Sean Lehman is back with us. Hi, Sean.
Always great to be here, Evan.
Well, let's just do this here. Before we get into some of the specific criticism, a little bit of a walk through history, because at least when I think back 10 years or so ago, Sean Lehman, I really remember 2010, 2011, the use of this medium picked up. And judges, every courtroom I walked into, I think, to cover trials back in my TV reporting days, it felt like the rules were different. I spend a lot less time in courtrooms these days because my job has changed. But I talk to colleagues and I get the sense that there's more uniformity, more of an expectation. Is that generally fair?
I'd say that observation is fair. I spend a lot of time in courtrooms, and most judges are open to the use of, we're using our smartphones there. The big concern they still have is that we not take any pictures there. And most spectators are banned from using their cell phones still in the courtroom for that reason. But yes, universally, I think it's much more widely accepted today.
Okay. Will, what's your experience been in the courtroom?
They've done a lot in this particular section of New York, you know, in this district to open up courtrooms. It starts from the top and it's kind of filtered its way down, and they want reporters to be able to report from these trials. So generally the trials are open and we're allowed to use our smartphones, you know, through social media and live tweeting.
Sean, Will, give us a sense for when you will decide to live tweet during a trial. Do you have to be covering it every day and not miss any testimony? Does it have to be high profile? Will you live tweet if you're only covering one day of a multi-day trial? What's the standard there, Sean?
For me, I typically, if I'm going to cover a trial every day of the trial, that means that there's intense public interest in it, and so I probably will live tweet. I'm not transcribing everything that every witness says. The difference for me, as I see, typically, if I would go in and spend 8 hours in a courtroom listening to testimony, what I'm going to do at the end of the day is distill that down into an 800 or 1,000 word story. But as I'm tweeting, what I'm really doing is serving as an observer. I'm reporting in real time what I'm seeing. I try to be cognizant of the fact that people may see those tweets out of context. They may not be as familiar with the case. And so I try to be judicious in what I'm doing. As I said, I'm not attempting to provide a transcript. But when there's a case that attracts a lot of interest, people who are following you on Twitter, I like to think generally know the facts of the case or think they know the facts of the case. And so that's what I'm doing, is serving that audience that has interest in the case, that generally knows what's going on and want to know exactly what's happening today.
Okay. Will, what about your standards there?
I look at it this way. So I used to be able to take notes. You know, I would bring my notebook, and like I was covering part of the Wilburn trial last week, opening statements in federal court, where federal court everything is closed. So they take our electronic devices, they take, you know, our phones, so there's no tweeting. So you're taking notes like you're in, like, you know, your freshman level class again in college. And for state and local courts, you know, city, county, and state, the phone has kind of become the reporter's notebook, as it were. So I use that as my kind of my guide for when I'm going back and compiling my story, that I gather all of my notes and use those to kind of organize my thoughts when I go to, like Sean said, to, you know, distill it to that 800 word story. So I think intense public interest is really what drives it, and it makes it, you know, a lot more transparent that you're having these open courtrooms.
Now, I know that Dr. Murray will have a lot to say in this, but let me, before I turn to Scott Ballou for a little bit of his legal perspective, and then we'll kind of get into where some of the criticism lies, I do want to ask you about the distinction you just made, Will. Federal court, you can't take your phone in.
Exactly.
You've got to make notes on your own. So obviously you can't use technology to instantly report, in a sense. And you've got to use that collection of notes to then create a story out of at least the biggest picture that you can walk out of that courtroom with that day or from that trial. Whereas if you are in a different court, you consider Twitter, for example, as kind of a reporter's notebook. But a reporter's notebook in federal court isn't – sometimes you need the notes in their totality to understand what you're seeing. Sometimes you need to kind of take a look at, well, did this person said this? Here's this piece of evidence and testimony. Why does that reporter's notebook need to be put out to the public?
It doesn't necessarily, but I think that you want these courtrooms to be open. You want people to have access to the court. So everything that we're reporting on are public proceedings. We're not doing something that's, you know, behind closed doors. We're reporting on something that the public has a right to know. So I think drawing the distinction between federal and state and local is kind of dangerous. And I think it's easy for someone to say, you know, why do you have to, or why shouldn't you do this, or why should you do this? I look at it this way, that I'm just doing my job in the way that the audience has evolved. You know, I mean, it's
sure.
It's, you know, people want instant access to this information, and I'm merely providing that, you know, in my role as a journalist.
Well, the reason I'm going to grill you guys more is because I'm more on your side on this one. I have a bias naturally in this, and generally my bias as a journalist tends to be towards sunlight and transparency and openness. I do understand the criticism, and I want to explore that in good faith this hour. Scott Maloof, from your perspective as an attorney, give me the look at the legal landscape to what a judge can and can't do. I mean, the judge is sort of in charge of the courtroom, but it was frustrating a decade ago when we didn't know walking in what we'd be allowed to do. As you're hearing from the reporters, there's more uniformity, but how much can a judge actually say, you can't do that? You cannot use the technology. You can use a notepad. They can do that, I guess.
Right. So big distinction between state court and federal court. Federal court's very much more closed off. You know, you cannot bring devices in, so you couldn't even live tweet if you wanted to. The inclination of federal courts is to be much more closed off, as we've seen, even to more traditional media. And state courts varies, obviously, across the country, but they are much more open. And the judges are looking at one of the big things is there going to be a witness testifying? And if there's going to be a witness testifying or the potential, then they look at the civil rights law of the state that talks about, okay, you know, we are not going to have any kind of audiovisual broadcasting of that. We're not going to have any recording of that. And then when you move away from that, when you have sentencing or other situations where you're not having the potential for testimony, it is much more of an open field where you can have, you know, cameras in the courtroom. And then secondarily, there are some layers over that of rules from the chief judge of the courts here in the state, who looks at, you know, how will the courts be affected by this? The big rule is you want a defendant to have a fair trial. You do not want to have a lot of problems. A good example is long ago, Sam Shepard, you know, the case where the physician allegedly had murdered his wife. During that trial, was the early days of television, they allowed cameras in the courtroom. They had so much of a media presence that the attorneys, the judges, the witnesses, the judge and the witnesses had difficulty being heard. and there was such a commotion in the courthouse, you know, in the hallways, that the trial couldn't be carried on. So those, that's the balancing factor. We want the public to see what's going on, but we've got to make sure there's a fair trial for the defendant and that the proceeding moves appropriately.
Okay. Does it make sense that at each individual level, there is a sort of a more uniform standard, though? Because as Will says, in federal court, you can't do it. Right now, at other levels of court, you can. Should there be a uniform standard, Scott?
You know, that's really difficult because, for example, with minors, we have traditionally said we are not going to make their experiences public. And so even with the standards of, you know, 50 years ago, we've closed that off and said, for example, we use, you know, initials instead of their full names. Some states have gone the other way and made those much more public. So I'm a little against the uniformity. And then remember, we are just talking one thing, the traditional court proceeding, maybe a family law or a criminal case. There's tons of other things. There are administrative bureaus where you may want the ability for people to come in and see our parking tickets being fairly adjudicated, our speeding tickets, or, you know, if you know someone, is it just going away? So there's a whole litany of other kind of things. It's very difficult to say this is a uniform thing. Good example, trade secrets, right? If you're Apple, you may say, I don't care that this is a civil case. This is how we created these products. We are not going to share our trade secrets with the world.
Okay. Let me turn to the other side of the table. I'm going to start with Dr. Elizabeth Murray, who was called to testify in the trial that we were talking about, with an allegation of rape against a local teacher this past summer. And you raised concerns about what specifically? Take me through your experience and what stood out to you.
So it's not a question of sharing the information. I mean, I think I have a pretty good track record of wanting to make sure people have accurate information, and I think Twitter is a very powerful, wonderful medium. I just want us to all be on the same page of how we're using it when we're covering these potentially sensitive subjects. And I think that I see it as a different medium, kind of what you alluded to before, of it's fast moving versus an edited, reviewed story. And I think you can get all the information out that you want in an edited way where we're not potentially making errors. And it doesn't necessarily, I don't know that the audience really is benefiting that much by having it so fast and so real time, because what we saw was, unfortunately, information being released that perhaps that definitely should not have been released. And again, no one was being malicious. I think it's just the fast-paced nature of it. And I think that, well, I think, I don't know, you guys across the table let me know, but I think that this is not something that's initially practiced in journalism school. And live tweeting is a skill. It's hard. And when things are going fast and you're trying to get information out there, and maybe you're a brand new reporter and you don't understand the subtleties of, you know, releasing one person's name in the case and how that could potentially identify other people, or just various components of it, or it's going so fast, it's easy to have a typo where you get the date wrong or something along those lines. And so I 100% think that information should go out there. We should definitely be transparent. There is nothing about any of our court proceedings, for the most part, obviously, I guess maybe witness protection or whatever the federal cases may be. But for the most part, our court proceedings should be definitely very transparent. I just want to make sure that the information is getting out there in a sensitive and appropriate way. I had concerns based on some of the tweets that had gone out that information that the public, highly detailed information that just the public did not need to have, that would be detrimental to the people involved, would get out there. And it wouldn't really add anything to the transfer of information in the case.
I want to be careful because I want to fully understand what you're saying, and if I ask something that's too specific, we can lay off it or we can be more general here. But were there specific moments when you were kind of reviewing the tweets that were happening after your testimony or during the trial, or were there actual bits of information or disinformation that stand out that you say, look, here's an example of why this is dangerous?
Yes, a relative was identified.
A relative of, okay, of a student making the accusation was identified.
Yes.
And so thereby, the student
Identifying the person
making the accusation, yeah. Okay, so my understanding is that came through a picture that was tweeted, I think, of people walking out of court?
I'm not sure if there was a picture involved.
There
was just, I mean, both, I believe.
I thought it was both.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if there was a picture, but there was definitely a name.
Okay. And so... Will, I know you were there. So, what's the remedy when something like that happens?
It needs to be swift. You need to pull that reporter aside. In this case, it was a TV reporter. You need to pull that reporter aside, and the judge needs to explain, you know, what happened and why this can't happen. That person needs to be very hyper aware and hypersensitive to what's going on in the courtroom. I know for a fact that no one in my newsroom was responsible for the information that Dr. Murray's talking about, that we were very sensitive to the information that we released. We never named the victim. We didn't name the victim's parents. We didn't identify, like they talked at one point when said that, you know, the victim had moved out of the area after all these allegations. We didn't identify where the family had moved. I mean, we were very, very, very sensitive to that. So, I mean, it's obviously a case-by-case basis. But in this case, I think you need to make sure that the reporter is aware of what happened and how this can happen. And, you know, just you need to be swift, like I said.
Yeah, and the trick is you can't unring the bell, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you can delete the tweet, but once people have seen it, people have seen it. And so that's why I just think that this is a great opportunity, and I'm really excited that we're having this conversation, because I think that this is a skill set. And it's a new skill. It's a relatively new skill, and we need to teach people how to use the skill appropriately. And I think it doesn't really surprise me that at least anecdotally the print reporters seem to have a better handle on it, because I think just that's my outside opinion looking in, that, you know, you guys are used to writing out your stuff, and obviously TV journalists write out their stuff, but I think you have a different thought process about how you guys go through putting together a story.
All right, so a couple of things here. Because in a moment, I want to hear Allie's perspective as we think about victims, especially in sensitive cases where there's allegations of sexual assault, rape, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But Dr. Murray brings up an important point here that sort of sticks with me, given that I've taught all of one adjunct journalism course in my life. But but I'm very sensitive about the fact that I think modern J schools can do a lot better. I think it was 20 or 30 years ago that the author Michael Lewis wrote the definitive J school takedown article. It's still a great read. But modern J schools, and again, we respect our colleagues in various places, but you're right. There ought to be literally a course on live tweeting or social media usage in real time. Mm-hmm. There should be a course. Absolutely. And what you're calling for, to my ear, is not a ban on these communications, but better training at a minimum. Now, you
100%.
Would,
that's exactly
so
what I'm saying.
We may agree there.
Yeah.
But you would go so far as to say that in certain cases or certain, would you say all sexual assault or rape allegations, et cetera, would you like judges to say no live tweeting?
Probably. I don't know. I mean, I just am not sure if putting, you know, if we say, and the doctor reported her hymen looked like this, how is that beneficial? And I can see that being very detrimental to any person, just to have people out there thinking about their genitals. I mean, it just, I think it's graphic information that's not really adding to the story. I think sharing information about misperceptions, like, you know, we know the overwhelming majority of children who survive sexual abuse have completely normal physical exams. That flies in the face of general common knowledge and what we see on Law and Order and things like that. So transferring that information, the general kind of information, so the public can understand the truth of the science, I think that kind of stuff. But the highly detailed specific information to the person's physical exam, I'm not sure that adds a lot.
But wasn't that vital information in the trial? I mean, that was vital evidence that the jury considered. Why wouldn't that be something that the public has the right to know?
So I think saying the general information of the exam was normal and this is what we think about normal exams is fine. My concern would be that you're going fast and now it's Dr. Murray said the person's hymen looked like this. Or just, you know, again, the highly detailed information going out so fast wouldn't really add anything. The edited, concise narrative of your story could be put together without highly detailed information like that. I guess to me those seem different. Maybe I'm too sensitive to
different. Go ahead, Scott.
Let me just interject. So I've live tweeted, not trials, and I follow a lot of trials. And I think without this sort of middle ground of people live blogging or live tweeting, you lose a lot of information. So folks have said, you know, Will said, Sean said, okay, I get this information. I edit it down to 800 or 1,000. But if what we're talking about is fundamentally different, and I think there's a lot of uses we have to be aware of. So I might want that information to say, okay, over the course of 10 or 100 or 1,000 trials, how did people interact with that if I were a professor? You know, if I'm a criminal defense attorney, I want to see what was the reaction to that. How did that you know, people take that information in? Also, we have to remember that maybe, you know, as much as people should be buying their newspaper, that's a plug, you know, get out there and
well,
subscribe.
They should.
A lot of people are following things like the Tan trial here in town. Mm-hmm. I know people, I was just talking to people and somebody said, oh yeah, I'm watching it right here on Twitter. So we have to be aware there are multiple audiences. And remember, there are people who are not traditional journalists who may be coming in and tweeting and live blogging. So there's a whole panoply of other uses for it that we have to be considerate of. So I would object to saying I have to wait till the media story comes out. I may want that raw stuff coming along, but recognize there can be downsides.
I want to put a pin in this because in a moment we're going to return to the larger question, what are the downsides? What are the benefits? Because I've got some thoughts about that, having live-tweeted trials, and I think these questions are fair. I want to bring in Allie and just ask you from the perspective of someone who has worked with victims, do you see more downsides, or do you have concerns with the way these kind of cases and trials are reported via social media in real time?
So I think that from our perspective, one of the challenges with these issues is the sensationalism, and you specifically talked about this was a sensational trial. People were interested in it. Well, what makes a trial sensational? The trial becomes sensational because how it's reported, right? And even leading up to it, kind of the hype that goes into what's being discussed and how topical is that right now? And issues right now of violence against women and sexual violence are very, very timely and thus become sensational. And it doesn't make it any easier for victims to want to come forward. And it puts them on the spot and it frightens them. So, and the media plays a gigantic role in helping victims recognize that it's okay to come forward. So it's this really bizarre juxtaposition that we're trying to manage because we want victims to know that your voice matters. We want to hear you, and something happened to you that wasn't, you know, in the court of law, we're trying to determine the fault and the blame, which is part of what makes this so difficult. And in these issues of sexual violence and domestic violence, the victim is really often the one on trial. That's how it's perceived. That's how it's experienced, because they are the one that was there. Often there's no witnesses. There may be expert testimony after the fact, but they're the one who has to recount the story. So they perceive this experience as being on trial. And when we're reporting it in the moment, we're putting them in the hot seat, and then their words kind of live on forever. And that's really painful and difficult to manage.
So what do you want journalists to do?
That's a great question. Because I don't know that it's consistent from one case to the next, to the next, to the next. For example, we've got the Harvey Weinstein trial coming up, right? That's going to be a huge, sensational trial. Everybody's really interested in that. We were all interested in the trial of Larry Nassar. And I think it did a good thing for victims to hear the voices of all of those victims come forward and their testimony at the end of the trial. And that went to sentencing. So that was a wonderful thing for victims, that they got to have their voices and have them shared across the country. I think that when people saw that father at the end of the Nassar trial say, give me 15 minutes with this guy, and then he went across the table, that was not that man's proudest moment. But, you know, every parent in America who has a kid said, I totally get you and I support you. And it went viral because we all loved him for wanting to protect his child, right? So this is difficult. If we can give the victim voice in a way that they aren't in the hot seat, you know, at that point of sentencing, when we talk and we hear from them about the impact this experience has had on them, that's valid. And it says to other victims, you're not alone, and it takes courage to come forward, and the world is supporting you. But to do that during the course of the trial, we are adding to their burden.
Evan, I just want to interject, but we also have to remember the rights of the defendant. Mm-hmm. So in this case, you know, the defendant was exonerated.
You're talking about in the Webster case.
In the Webster case, the defendant was exonerated, and so we have to remember the defendant's liberties are on trial. The defendant may be the one who goes to jail. The Sam Shepard case, he went to jail for 10 years and then got a retrial, and I think he was exonerated on retrial. So we have to remember that is 10 years. That person may never get back. So we've got to keep that in mind. The defendant has a right to a vigorous cross-exam, and if the court is open at that time, you know, that may need to be reported. And also reputational issues. You know, if a trial or a crime is, you know, an indictment is brought or criminal charges are filed, you know, often the district attorney is going to talk about it. The defense, you know, bar, the defendant may not even have the money to do it. So the live tweeting from the trial, if testimony is not believable or how long the jury was out, things like that, can tell the defendant's story in a way that was not told. So we're really trying to balance all these things out. And then going forward, you know, if a person is exonerated, they're looking for a job, you do a Google search, the first things that are going to come up are the stories about the charges. The exoneration may or may not come up. So, I mean, we're trying to balance a ton of competing interests, just to put it there.
Go ahead.
So I think that that's part of what's interesting. And I'm not suggesting that every person who brings a charge of sexual violence or domestic violence against their partner is 100% in the right. That's not at all what I'm suggesting. I'm just suggesting that the nuances of these cases are challenging. And I don't know that there's a whole lot of value in the grand scheme of things to either the victim or the alleged victim and the defense to having it out in the public sphere. You know, we're not trying this in the public case. You brought up the case of Charlie Tan. There was a whole lot of conversation about Charlie Tan in the first trial and what his family was like. None of that was actually even brought in by the defense, and that's how he got off. But there was this whole public debate going on about who he was and where he came from and was he or was he not justified in his behavior, and I got plenty of opinions on that. But, you know, it just the way that it was experienced through journalism versus what actually happened in the court, what was brought as part of the case, and what mattered at the end of the day to the jury didn't really land on people.
If I could, just for a moment, offer one view on a possible benefit that I think hasn't been brought up yet. So I was one of the reporters who probably the most live tweeting I've ever done during a case was the case in which after the passing of Heather Boyum in Fairport, mm-hmm. which I think was 2013. Mm-hmm. Beloved figure in that community, out on a weekend morning, a nice morning in Parenton or Fairport, mm-hmm. and was hit and killed by a vehicle operated by, well, there were two people operating vehicles, and they were not at all sober. And I don't remember every detail. I want to be careful and to be mm-hmm. fair. But it was intense interest. It was a shocking death. Mm-hmm. And I had emails, I mean dozens of emails a week from colleagues of Heather Boyum, from friends, saying, thank you for keeping us informed. We feel like we're hanging on every moment here. And I knew the weight of it. So I was live tweeting this, mm-hmm. and it was I felt a ton of weight to be right, to be accurate. But there was also something going on here. District attorneys are elected. They have a lot of say in the makeup of the DAs. And in the case where something doesn't go the way certain people would want, whatever you are watching a trial, if your evaluation is, I watched this trial, I cannot believe that such and such lost, air quotes, or won this trial, you could say, well, you know, Heather Boyum was hit and killed. And by the way, I mean, I know it's always hard to hear it. And her name is coming up, and people who know her were not warned. And we care about you, and I know you miss her, so I'm sorry about that. But if there's a shock, if you feel like something was mismanaged, and you just see a short report at the end of a trial that could go on for weeks versus a record of what was the approach that the prosecutor was taking, how did they handle it, how did they conduct themselves, that may offer people, the broader public, a better chance to hold people accountable if they think they haven't done a good job. And I think to some degree, we're there to help the public see what's happening on all sides and help people decide if there is an accountability issue or not. And I'm not saying in that case there was or wasn't. I'm just remembering the weight of the emotion and the interest that people had and the weight I felt to get it right. But there was a lot of conversation with our executive producer at the time, Sean Carroll, and many other people about how we're doing this, what the standards are. So I see the benefits, but I'm hearing you. You know, and I want to ask the reporters, I want to ask Will and Sean, I want to ask you very directly if you see downsides, because I just heard from Charles Molyneux, who's with Channel 10, WHEC, News 10 NBC, and jumped on Twitter to say that he thinks the only downside is some reporters have faster thumbs than others, and he doesn't see any downside otherwise. Well, I disagree. There's downsides. We should be very serious about this as journalists. Every newsroom should. And the downsides are, if you're not careful, that testimony you thought you understood could be misrepresented in your tweets, and the public doesn't understand. An expert in sexual violence, anatomy, any other thing, whatever the case is, toxicology, is misunderstood. You've got to be really careful. So I do see the downsides. I want to ask Sean and Will if you do.
Yeah, I agree with that absolutely. And, you know, I would say that we have a lot of conversations in our newsroom about the topics that or the concerns that have been raised here, in not only in general when we talk about how we cover victims of sexual abuse, but in specific instances, how are we going to cover this trial that just took place or other cases. We're very cognizant of that. You know, we're writing a lot of stories right now about lawsuits being brought under the Child Victims Act. There's mm-hmm. hundreds of them. And in general, we don't identify victims of sexual abuse, even if they're adults, just as a matter of policy. But there's a lot of nuance beyond that. And this particular case, I think, was unusual in some of its details. It's unusual for a judge, I think, to instruct reporters in the room not to report on specific testimony. But I think it's important that we as journalists have these conversations, not just in general, but about specific cases. And I think what happens sometimes in the course of a trial is a reporter gets sent over for the day and maybe not up to speed on what's going, maybe hasn't been briefed on some of the sensitivities of the case. You know, I think Will and I both, in our trial coverage, it's not unusual for us to have conversations with the victim's assistance folks at the DA's office mm-hmm. beforehand, saying, please be sensitive to this. This witness would prefer not to be identified, things like that. And we try to honor that. We can report the story without, as you said, getting into the grisly details of that. Mm-hmm. We have to make those choices all the time. Will is out a lot at crime scenes, at accident scenes, at fires. And he has to make choices every day about what details he's going to report. We don't want to misstate what has happened. We don't want people to hear from us first that somebody they know has died. We certainly don't want to put wrong information out there. And so I think what's important is to have these conversations among ourselves, but also to hear from people who work with victims about the consequence of our coverage, not just to that individual person, but to other victims who may be impacted by that, who may be a victim and who see what happened in this particular case and say, I don't want to go through that.
Will, what do you think?
I totally concur with what Sean just said. I think you have to take it on a case-by-case basis. You can't, I mean, like you said, we do have some hard and fast, you know, policies where we don't obviously report on suicides, we don't report on victims' names, especially in sexual abuse
and
cases.
Typically minors who are victims.
Right, exactly.
Of crime. Yep.
And so, I mean, but it's also, it has to be an ongoing conversation. You can't just have a policy that's not fluid. You need to make sure mm-hmm. that you're discussing these instances with both people in your newsroom and also editors. And it's awesome to hear from the public because, you know, you want that transparency, but you want to make sure that you're reporting honestly and accurately, and in the case of Twitter, you have to be quick. And I think a lot of the downside that would, like, that Dr. Murray was speaking of, you know, kind of talking about, like, I mean, she was referencing some of the tweets that I had during the Webster trial, where I misstated some of the dates that the prosecution was talking about, and almost instantaneously I had two or three readers that would text back or tweet back to me and say, you know, this, are you talking about this? Are you talking about this? So I'm able to correct that, but you need to make sure that you're open to that criticism too. But like Sean said, I think it's important that we have these conversations because all of us can't do better in our jobs if we're not open to listening to people. And I think that's why I think this is a very important conversation.
Here's what I want to do when we come back from our early break of the hour. I want to circle back to a point that I think maybe needs more emphasis from Ali O'Malley about the impact on people in the future, victims and coming forward and what they see and the experience they have and what this means. And frankly, what our job as journalists are in those cases. And also the question on expert testimony. I'm curious to know in the future if Dr. Murray, when she testifies again, is going to be concerned that, you know, will reporters understand the information well enough? And what is that like from the perspective of an expert witness? So we're talking about the way modern technology allows us to report, particularly live tweet and cover these kinds of cases, often sensitive cases. Dr. Elizabeth Murray is here, a pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital. She testified in that the case regarding a Webster teacher and allegations of rape this past summer. And Allison O'Malley is the chief executive officer of Resolve, talking about the perspective of sexual abuse and sexual violence victims. Scott Maloof is an attorney whose practice focuses on the intersection of social media and the law, and two reporters from the Democrat and Chronicle who do a lot of live tweeting and a lot of great coverage, frankly, for our community of these kinds of cases. Will Cleveland and Sean Lehman. We're right back on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Allison O'Malley from Resolve was talking about the way victims of sexual violence are already dealing with the question of whether to talk at all. I mean, talk publicly, talk to a friend, talk to police. What are those conversations generally like? And do you think there's a way to cover these cases in a way that is more reassuring for them?
Okay. You know, it really goes from person to person to person. So there are folks who have gone through an experience of sexual assault or rape, or even in cases of domestic violence, who are angry and really are looking for justice. And they have a very clear picture in their mind of what they think justice is for them. And then they're more willing to be cooperative in the court process. They're participating in the court process. And they may very well be willing to have their name out in the world because it's part of how they perceive the process of getting justice. They want their voices heard and they want their name tied to it. And they're ready for their experience to be known. And then there are many, many victims who may be equally as angry, but just are so humiliated, so deeply ashamed, so traumatized by their experience that even putting them on the stand and pursuing justice in any form is another degree of violation. And they are just, again, humiliated in the process, and they're forced to relive something that never should have occurred in the first place. It's difficult to, again, establish a policy, a one rule that says everybody's going to be okay if we do it this way. I appreciate your comment, Sean, about, you know, making sure you connect with the victims' advocates when you're going in the room and making sure that we have a general idea of who is this person today and how do they want us to play. And that, again, is not to say that we don't have to be responsive to the needs of the accused, but maybe that same conversation needs to happen around, you know, how does that person have their story represented?
It's a very important point that you raise because, as I mentioned, I've written a lot about these sex abuse claims against the Catholic Church and other mm-hmm. things. Those tend to be adults who are more removed from that. But what I hear from a lot of those people, and many of whom don't want to come forward publicly, but they say, hearing other people's stories, they feel empowered to come forward mm-hmm. with their own. But obviously, I'm only seeing half of that picture because what I'm not hearing from are the people who read my coverage and have the opposite reaction, mm-hmm. who say, I don't want to go through that. I don't want people to know what happened to me. Yep. I don't even want to talk about it. I don't want my parents to find out what happened to
That's
me.
That's right.
And so I appreciate you raising that point as well.
Yeah. Dr. Murray, you want to jump in
and
too?
I think we have to remember too, a lot of these people are 6 years old and they don't know what they right. need or want. And then in 10 years, they Google themselves or they Google their abuser and they see all of this information that was written about them. And while it might be they are the only ones who know it, I don't know what it would be like to mm-hmm. process that. You know, I get a little bit worried and I understand, of course, high profile cases are just that. They are high profile. But from a victim standpoint, the little girl whose abuser was just convicted a few weeks ago of sexual abuse in a case that's much, much more representative of the overwhelming majority of cases. You know, 90% of children are abused by somebody they know, love or trust, you know, right mm-hmm. in their environment. You know, that wasn't live tweeted. That didn't receive the coverage. And that's just because didn't have the cachet, perhaps, that a coach being a potential abuser is. And so it makes me more nervous that people who are high profile or in positions, more positions of power, are going to have victims who are going to be more and more scared to come forward because they know the added layer of the amount of publicity to excruciating detail is likely going to happen.
Sure.
I think that's an interesting point that you just made, Dr. Burry, too, about, you know, what makes a case sensational was my earlier question. Mm-hmm. And then this particular case, it was because it was a coach to a child. And so, you know, and it's sexual violence. So, and it's, you know, 2 years out from the Larry Nassar thing and this whole perception of coaches, you know, victimizing children, it makes it more sensational. You know, I do wonder, and I'm literally just, this thought came to me as she was speaking, the realities of sexual violence, the realities of child abuse, these are things that happen the vast majority of the time in the context of known relationships. Mm-hmm. And when it hits the news, when we're really talking about it, it is in the context of that stranger violence, which perpetuates that myth. And so maybe part of the conversation around how does the media report on these cases is they report on them whether they're sensational or not. Maybe it's a conversation about we're taking this problem that has been hidden in the shadows for so long and saying, nope, we're going to put it out there universally. And that way, more people can come forward and know that I'm not going to be shamed or humiliated or embarrassed because you media have helped me understand that I am not alone.
Let me just add something. The challenge I see, though, is we've kind of talked just about the media. There's a lot of non-media actors in these situations. You know, a lot of law bloggers, a lot of people who tweet other, you know, I will see other attorneys who tweet. And so we have to be careful that we do not create a system that disincentivizes that, you know. So, for example, we want to bring out more kinds of these stories. We don't want it just to be the coach and the student. Well, you have to then incentivize those bloggers to come and cover just the average trial. But also, we don't want to say you have to keep this perfect because the cost of perfect is paralysis. Mm-hmm. You know, you're never, while you're live tweeting, you're like, oh, did I get that right? You can't go back. There's no repeat on testimony. So you have to say, I got it somewhere in the right space. And then finally, you know, we have to make sure the economics works. You know, if we're going to say, you know, media organization, you've got to get everything perfect, but this other person who's not a journalist, you don't have to, you're going to disincentivize and create a system where I think we don't get the coverage that maybe we want. So, again, it's always these competing priorities that we have to look at.
Yeah, but journalists are the professionals, and so I'm okay with holding a professional to a little bit of a different standard, I think. And again, I don't think anybody's coming at this from a malicious standpoint. I think this is a learned skill, and so that's why I'm just advocating for practicing the skill to make sure that everybody understands the subtleties of it, because I think a lot of those subtleties are not obvious, right? They're subtleties.
What does practice look like then? I mean, you're advocating for practice. What do you envision that we could do differently? I mean, I graduated from the University of Montana in 2005. My degree still says print journalism. You know, I didn't learn to live tweet anything until I started covering high school sports. You know, where I'm covering a football game, trying to get updates out, and that's kind of how I picked up the skill of, you know, being quick and being things of, like being like that. So how do we get better? I mean, it's definitely a learned skill. It's not anything I was taught. It's something that I've only learned through experience.
I think practicing in something that's less innocuous, like a sporting game. I understand. I'm sorry. Some sports fans might be very upset, but
no, we can agree on
but,
that.
But you know, but also having leadership that you have that says these are the things that you need to keep in your front of mind as you're doing it. I think as simple as that conversation might be, that's probably pretty powerful to you, where if you are right out of school and have never covered a trial like this before, it might not be even in your frame of reference that there's some stuff that needs to be off limits. And so it could be as simple as having that conversation. It also could be you spend an hour watching a TV show and live, you know, you don't send it out, but practice typing out what the cast of the characters are saying. I don't exactly know. I haven't been to journalism school, but I think that even simple amounts of practice and kind of a heads up of some things that might sound really obvious could be very, very beneficial.
Well, before the hour is up here, Christine writes to ask if reporters ever inject personal commentary when they are live tweeting or analysis. And this kind of gets me back to the question on expert testimony, because again, I want to be careful. There are some years that have passed since the trial involving Meghan Markle, Mark Skirbo in Fairport. But there was not just a conversation, and we can even speak generally. Sometimes conversations are not just about alcohol consumption, but take bath salts, which are recreational drugs, and they'll have a different effect on the body, will impact and impair in different ways. I happened, in covering that trial, one of my good friends in Rochester is the former head of the drug section at the Monroe County Crime Lab. And I had a chance to talk to him just for background, to understand, help me understand bath salts. What do you know about them? Knowing that I could go into court and have a better chance of at least understanding what the testimony meant and why certain things were going in the direction they were, because otherwise I had no expertise with it. Not even to say I'm a toxicologist with alcohol. I mean, I certainly am not an expert there either. So that was helpful. And occasionally, as I recall, I might have characterized the prosecutor could be doing X because of X, but I always try to caveat that. That's just, you know, the view after talking to experts. I try not to joke. Christine's asking if reporters joke, or I hope that you are not flippant.
No,
Sean, I mean, I know you guys aren't.
I mean, oftentimes what I will do is if it's a complex testimony or something we've written about in the past, I'll link out to a full story and say, here's the background on that.
Yep.
But I'm not equipped to do analysis or commentary as the testimony is
generally speaking
happening.
Me neither. Yeah, I think that's a really dangerous road to go down. And to Dr. Murray's point, if you're talking about training, that should be included here. You're not a real-time analyst when it comes to sexual assault or toxicology, unless you got a toxicology degree. Be very, very careful. Does it change your view on future testimony? Not the way you're going to give testimony in future cases, but the way you expect it might be reported. Do you have concerns about that?
I don't know. I think actually the Rochester community now is kind of acutely aware of these concerns. So I think actually here locally, it's probably going to be just fine. I don't know what's happening in other parts of the nation. I think it's a wide spectrum actually of what people are experiencing, from not being able to report anything to this has been going on for years and maybe they have people who are more used to doing it. You know, I have to do continuing education training for my career, and I think that you guys probably do too, and I don't. This could certainly be worked into something, a continuing training for journalists as well. It's definitely not going to change how I testify, because I testify to the facts of the case. So
absolutely. Go ahead, Scott.
But I just want to add, you know, an expert's testimony can be bogus too. An expert, you may have an expert who's not expert in that particular thing. They have great credentials, and they come in and they say, "Okay, I'm an expert on arson," but they can't really talk about how a fire maybe started in an electrical situation because it's just outside of their testimony. Or you can have two great experts who just disagree. They are interpreting, and that's part of why you bring an expert in. If it was common understanding, you don't need an expert. Was the car speeding? We don't need an expert to determine the speed of a car. We all know how fast that goes. But you bring the expert in for those other issues. So we still have to have that flexibility to say, you know what, here's what the expert reported. Yes, you should report it accurately, but there's going to be a second expert who comes and says, I disagree with that. So we can't just defer because the person is admitted as an expert.
But also at the end of the day, the jury's hearing all of the stuff they need to hear. We have to remember all this is for the jury's ears first and foremost, and then for the public's consumption, yes, that's a nice thing too, but the jury's always going to hear what they need to hear, what's legally allowed for them to hear.
30 seconds. Your final admonition for journalists who are listening right now. Allie, what do you want journalists to take from this conversation?
We need you to help lift the veil of isolation that victims and survivors feel, and be respectful.
That was very direct.
Mm-hmm. 30 seconds.
In less than 30 seconds.
I didn't know I was closing. I thought you were going to get us all.
I think ongoing training is not only important, but I think the media in general, maybe WXXI will host it, and we'll bring in people from different backgrounds and put it together, because this is part of, I mean, I don't think we're going back. Technology is probably not going to go back, and the question is, what do you do with it going forward? And I don't think we should be flippant. I think we should recognize the risks and recognize the possible benefits and all work in that direction. Thanks to everybody here. From the Democrat and Chronicle, Sean Lehman, Will Cleveland, we appreciate your work. We are proud subscribers here at XXI. Thank you very much.
Evan.
Thank you. Scott Maloof, an attorney whose practice focuses on the intersection of social media and the law. Always good, Scott.
Thanks, Evan.
ScottMaloof.com for more information on Scott's work. And you will find on Twitter Dr. Elizabeth Murray, who is a great communicator, pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Allison O'Malley, Chief Executive Officer of Resolve. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Short break. More connections coming up.
This program is a production of WXXI Public Radio. The views expressed